Professor David Andres is a historian of the French Revolution and of the social and cultural history of conflicts in Europe and the Atlantic world more generally in the period between 1760s and 1840s. He has written a number of books, the most well-known being The Terror, and has edited a major collection of essays, The Oxford Handbook of the French Revolution. Professor Andres, welcome.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Absolute pleasure. Let me begin with an admission, if I may, which is that I did go to university back home in Ljubljana in Slovenia, but I was a dreadful student. It took me almost 7 years to finish a four-year bachelor's degree in, drumroll, communication studies. We're not talking about quantum mechanics here. Some of this loss of face I have to lay at the feet of my university program, which was extremely bland and uninspiring. However, I did have one great subject for a semester only, unfortunately, which was called modern history. And it was great because the professor was an extremely passionate lecturer. Now, much to my shame, I don't remember much, but I do remember that one of the first things that he said during the first class that we had was that the French Revolution was the single most important event in all European history. Would you agree with this pretty ambitious statement? And if you do, why?
If you imagine there to be a thing called modern European history, and that thing, modern European history, has particularly distinctive qualities, then it's very reasonable to say that the French Revolution was the starting point for what that means. And particularly as it were coming out of a former Eastern Bloc country like Slovenia, where that sense of capital H history had been ingrained for decades, it's not surprising to find that kind of reference. But I think the interesting thing to reflect on, and what I hope we can talk about today, is that the French Revolution really is two very fundamentally different things. It's on the one hand, what people remember of it, and what people remember of it over the last 200 years, kind of from the 1820s onwards, really. The sense that the French Revolution as an event had happened and had transformed European history. That's something which was understood to have happened, again, in the generation that grew up in the echoes of the French Revolution, looking ahead all through the 19th century, that sense that it's a point of origin for all sorts of aspects of modernity that are transformational and you know, one-time only events. The other French Revolution, of course, is what actually happened and how people experienced and lived through that, why France collapsed into revolution in the first place, what people were hoping to get out of change. And that, in a sense, is a completely different story. And that's one of the interesting things about studying transformational events, is that it's after them that people get to decide what they mean. But that's often really quite radically different to what people who lived through them experienced. And studying history is partly about thinking about those retrospective meanings, but it's also about thinking about the actual experience of people, what they went through, what they were hoping for, and often what they suffered in the course of these events.
Wow, my mind is blown already, and I can pretty much throw all of my questions into the toilet now, because they're just about what happened, not about the memory of the events that happened.
You know, very, very, very long time.
Okay. So let's begin with a bit of a context. So the pre-revolution France of 1789 is the so-called Ancien Régime, with the king on top, roughly speaking. And then we have the three estates. I remember that much. The clergy, the aristocracy, and then everybody else, probably mostly peasants, who are the third estate and who represent the vast majority of people. I read somewhere that it was over 80%.
France in the 18th century is very much like most other continental European countries in terms of being a fundamentally kind of aristocratic constitution. Authority derives essentially from tradition and religion. and France being on the Catholic part of the continent, the Catholic Church, a really quite complicated historical political relationship with the Vatican, with the papacy, a sense that Catholic morality is one of the things that society exists to preserve. These are all part of it, alongside the values of an aristocracy and a nobility, which are essentially selfish and competitive values. And, you know, this is one of the things always interesting to reflect on when we look at these hierarchical societies. The people at the top, you know, the kings, princes, dukes, earls, all the rest of them, they are essentially in competition with each other all the time for power and influence. You know, this is the sort of the long-term history of the emergence of hereditary monarchy, is that it's a kind of referee for generations-long conflict between all the other powerful people in the kingdom. And one of the ways that powerful people consolidate their power, particularly in France in the 18th century, is by acquiring and hanging on to privilege, legal distinctions, things that mark them out as different from people below them. And this is one of the forces that's going to drive France into problems by the later 18th century, is that there is so much privilege floating around in society, so many ways in which people are legally entitled not to do things, particularly not to pay tax if you're powerful, that it clogs up the administration of a state which is trying to compete very vigorously on the global stage. You know, and this is another whole dimension of what's going on in France in the 18th century. It's locked into what's sometimes been called the Second Hundred Years' War with Britain, which is a global conflict for influence and power and colonial possessions, which has been going on since the later 1660s and 70s. And by the 1760s, 100 or so years after this has started, France finds itself in a very, very difficult position. It essentially loses the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 63. As part of losing that war, it loses the vast majority of its colonial territory in the Americas. It loses its foothold in India, loses other possessions on the coast of Africa connected with the slave trade. It manages to hang on to some of its really, really valuable slave colonies in the Caribbean. But it's essentially, as a power in the world, in a competitive diplomatic environment, France has been humiliated in this conflict. And it's also racked up an enormous debt. You know, on top of the debts of previous wars, France by the later 1760s is really, as a state, in serious danger of running out of money. You know, there's only so much money it can borrow on the financial markets and from its own citizenry. So between the later 1760s and the mid-1780s, France gets locked into, as a state, as a government, as a monarchy, gets locked into the idea that things need to change, but is then locked into fundamental disagreements about how to change things. That you have on the one hand this society of privilege, which looks on those privileges as possessions, as rights, as things that can't be challenged because tradition and hierarchy are very important. On the other hand, you have the Enlightenment, which is a topic for a whole other hour's conversation, but which is pressing primarily for the idea that you can and must have rational reform, that the state will only become stronger if it's rationalized in various ways. And you had the monarchy itself, Louis XV and then Louis XVI and their government ministers, essentially caught in the middle between these different forces, between constantly appeasing the powerful people in society and constantly trying to nag through some kind of reform that would actually make a difference. And this is the whole setting for what takes us towards the origins of the revolution, is essentially conflict amongst the elites in society about how to keep France powerful. Yeah, and again, this is one of the ironies of the situation, that you know, what's imagined and what is a great popular revolution emerges out of these conflicts, which are really amongst the elite about who gets to cling on to power. And the answer will turn out to be none of them, but, you know, for very complicated reasons.
So these are all very kind of big ideas, big currents of history. Mm-hmm. What's life, and I always ask this of every historian that comes on the show, but what was life of an average peasant, for example, in France just before the revolution like?
This is where these issues at the top of society connect very directly to living at, as it were, the bottom of society. As you said earlier, roughly 80% of the population is, in a general sense, rural. Over two-thirds of the population are actually engaged in agriculture, in peasant agriculture in various forms. So France is an essentially peasant society. The significant majority of the population are living as peasants. That means all sorts of different things. It can mean everything from being, you know, a landless labourer dependent on seasonal employment through to, you know, being a very relatively prosperous landowner who rents out a farm and can imagine their children becoming something better, you know, and all sorts of different levels of prosperity involved there. But structurally, socially, the peasantry are seen as inferior, and the social system is essentially designed to feed off of them. It's taken for granted that they are a resource which funds the lifestyles of the elite. And there's this great sort of triple burden that falls on the peasantry. The first pillar of this is taxation. As I said, most powerful people are privileged, which means they don't have to pay a lot of ordinary taxes. So the state has to batten on to the unprivileged majority for its core revenue. And they do that in all sorts of oppressive ways. I mean, one of the ways they do it, for example, is there will be appointed or even elected leaders in a peasant village, relatively prosperous members of the community. And they are forced by the state to take responsibility for tax gathering from their own neighbours. And they're forced, if they can't get the money from their neighbours, to pay it themselves. You know, they're placed under a constraint, under a burden, under a threat of punishment if they don't turn in the annual cash demand of the state. And that's in terms of direct taxes on land and things like that. Taxes on produce, taxes on moving things around, tolls and so on. They're rigorously enforced, often by armed agents of the state or armed agents of what they call tax farmers, capitalist corporations who've invested in the rights to collect taxes, and they profit if they can collect more than they've contracted for. And they use armed force to do this around the country. So taxation is, you know, really essentially oppressive. It's violent and coercive, and very little benefit from it comes back to the bulk of the population. The second pillar then
is, so where do the taxes go? You said they don't come, none of it comes back to these communities. Where do they go? I mean,
they pay for the state. They pay for armies and navies and palaces and so on. I mean, there's, you know, the general sense in a pre-democratic society that people are obliged to pay the powerful to be allowed to carry on existing. You know, that's the general nature. And you see that in the second pillar, which is the church, which collects tithes on the crops. So people are handing over anywhere between 5% and 15% of their gross return on agriculture to the Catholic Church. And there again, because the Catholic Church is entwined with this hierarchical aristocratic society, a lot of that money doesn't actually go to a parish priest to serve the community. A lot of it gets whipped up to the higher levels of the church, to abbeys, to cathedral chapters, to rich bishoprics, because, again, it's assumed to be right and proper and natural that important people are wealthy and can display their wealth. And that goes for being a bishop or an abbot as much as it does for a lord. So a lot of money is sucked out of the local communities to support an elite on the religious side, as well as on the state side. And then you get to the really interesting and complicated bit, which is what we call seigneurialism, which is the idea of being a lord of the manor in this context, where, again, misty medieval origins of this basic idea that there are lords and peasants, and the lords control and protect the peasants in the communities they have guardianship over. You know, but that's a very vague, lost in the mists of time idea. What it amounts to by the 18th century is that there are charters and packages of seigneurial rights, which include, for example, the right to have a share of the harvest, a right to have tolls on bridges, a right to a monopoly on milling, a right to run your own court and appoint your own bailiffs and judges to enforce these other rights. And that kind of package of seigneurialism, you know, it could be something that had been handed down through a family for generations. It's also something that you can just buy. You can buy these lordships on an open capitalist property market. They are investments for a lot of people by the end of the 18th century. And they represent this crazy paradox that they're essentially a product of an idea of a kind of military medieval feudal domination over the population that have become almost a sort of capitalist retirement fund for the rising middle classes. If you are a lawyer or a merchant in late 18th century France, one of the things you do to secure the future of your family is go out and, you know, possibly even answer a small ad in the newspaper to buy the feudal rights over a village or a collection of villages somewhere, anywhere in France. And once you've bought them, once you've been given the piece of paper, you can then just employ a lawyer and a bailiff to go down to that village and say, everyone has to pay me now. And the peasants have to hand over a significant chunk of their income to you as your personal income forever. You know, you buy social superiority over them, and with that comes an economic benefit to you. Yeah. So the peasantry, that vast majority of the population, are living under these conditions where the state and the church and the wealthier parts of the society all treat them as a resource, all look at them as inferior and obliged to economically support the people above them, and that just is the way things are. And one of the really notable things about as France falls into revolution is how that's going to be challenged immediately from below.
How much of a peasant or a farmer's monthly income was sucked away by various taxes and tithes to the church and so forth?
I mean, it's quite I mean, they wouldn't have had a monthly income, obviously, because their income primarily comes right from the harvest. So you have an annual cycle of impoverishment and relative prosperity. One of the things you always see that in the spring, for example, last year's crop is running out and this year's crop hasn't been gathered. There is always a sort of impoverishment, April to August, when people are very badly off, and then they're all hoping for the harvest to come in. But when the harvest does come in, again, you're looking at really anywhere between 5% and 15% going to the church, similar amounts probably going to the state, and then really possibly even slightly more than that going to the seigneur. So overall, depending on where you are in the country, it could be relately light. It could be 25 to 30% of the crop overall. It could be as much as half the crop. And you see situations where you can look at the records of how people cope with this. And one of the ways people cope with this is, you know, they will own some land, they will rent some land. They may have what's called a sharecropping agreement over other land, where the rent is essentially a share of the harvest, which will be handed over at the end. Households scramble around to make this work, to find a way of having kind of economic stability, because whatever they do, they have to pay over a significant chunk of it to someone else. And again, it's interesting to reflect that the French peasantry are, in the medium term, in the sort of the second half of the 18th century altogether, doing quite well because they work so very hard, that the population is rising and is being fed. You know, France isn't collapsing into long-term famine or anything. So agricultural productivity is increasing. But the pressure to keep that up under the weight of all these burdens is felt very strongly by the peasantry, who are often being pushed to legally challenge the rights of their seigneur in particular. There are ongoing fights in the courts between communities and lords over whether or not they do actually need to pay this or that or the other. Often when a lord buys those rights, they attempt to tighten up the enforcement of them. Sometimes that involves inventing new rights, claiming rights that don't actually seem to exist. And then the peasantry can use the royal courts to challenge that contention. But in terms of the peasantry, again, this is a burden being placed on them. They have to defend themselves against attempts to extract even more revenue from them. And as you go into the 1780s, the economic conditions are actually starting to worsen. There's a sort of very complicated trade depression, problems with the harvests over the long term, where it's becoming much, much harder to be safe as an agricultural producer. The risk of destitution is growing quite significantly.
So in those conditions, do people go hungry or bankrupt more often?
A lot of people are hungry. There is an impoverished class at the bottom of society, which, except in a very good year, is always going to be about 10% of the whole population. One of the things that historians in the early 20th century worked out, looking at the economic crisis that has kicked in through the middle 1780s, is that on the eve of the revolution itself, 1788, 1789, possibly as much as one in five of the whole population were effectively destitute, unable to feed themselves, possibly driven to going on the road, in search of work, in search of charity. That France, in some senses, was perceived as being almost under siege by beggars, by poverty, at this moment. And that's another significant development of the crisis, that the bottom had sort of fallen out of the economy and produced this very large number of impoverished people who are perceived as dangerous, as a problem, and they frighten everybody else. And this is another part of the breakdown that's going to become a revolution.
All right, if we turn the tables so we can appreciate the contrast, how far removed from these kind of existential worries were the royals and the upper aristocracy? Could you sort of sketch the lavishness of their lifestyle a little bit?
Yes, absolutely, they are absolutely living in the lap of luxury. And this, again, is something that very many people are conscious of at the time. It's understood from the top down as necessary, normal and natural, that magnificence is one of the qualities that powerful people should display. They should look magnificent. They should have magnificent places to live. This is, if they don't do that, then they're not keeping up in a competition with other magnificent people. And since Louis XIV built Versailles in the 1680s, there's almost literally a competition around the great capitals of Europe to build magnificent palaces and then to fill them with artworks and statuary and so on and so forth. And of course, to dress in these phenomenally extravagant ways that you see in illustrations from the late 18th century, enormous dresses and skirts, enormous billowing wigs on the women, that sense that it's all about display, and that fashion and the cycle of fashion is about having the resources to always try and be at the forefront of that, never wearing the same clothes twice, having, you know, huge jewels, all this kind of stuff. You know, and Marie Antoinette, as Queen of France in the 1770s and 80s, is legendary for setting the standards for this, for spending, you know, amounts of money that would have fed entire villages for years on her clothes on a monthly basis. Because that level of difference between the top and bottom of society was understood as normal. One of the things that is happening under the influence of the Enlightenment is a challenge to that. But it's a challenge which ironically is then framed in essentially misogynistic terms, that what's wrong in this whole scenario is not the general pattern of luxury, but the specific conduct of women, the specific conduct of aristocratic women who are understood to be debauched. You know, that all this extravagance gives them too much of a role in public. They should go back to being wives and mothers. And the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau has been at the forefront of making this argument for a couple of decades, but by the eve of the revolution. A general sense from the more prosperous middle classes that the upper classes could be doing better and different things with all their wealth. They don't need to be spending it on all this extravagance. But at the same time, it's still completely normalized at the top of society that displaying wealth, displaying luxury is vital. And one of the government ministers who's in power in the 1780s actually says that it is vitally important, again, precisely to maintain the magnificence of the state, to maintain the confidence of the international investors who loan the state money. They must be seen to be able to waste that money ineffectively. You know, luxury, magnificence is a sign of economic health. If you're seen to cut back, if you're seen to be economical, it'll be understood that you're on the brink of collapse. So you can't do that. You have to display. Whereas at the same time, there is this very strong moral condemnation of luxury rising up. And again, these are just, again, other dimensions of the real tensions within French society about where you're going to go, given that you are, in fact, as a state, running out of money.
What a fascinating idea that in times of economic crisis, try to spend more on palaces and bigger wigs and bling.
It's a kind of crazy Keynesianism. You know, it is. You maintain confidence through extravagance.
So could the aristocracy, and I probably know what you're going to answer to this, but could the aristocracy relate to the problems facing the lower classes at all? Or were they so steep in the privileges you were talking about that it was impossible to even theoretically expect that of them?
There is a strong sense amongst some in the higher aristocracy that things need to change. But again, it's not perceived as this being, you know, because it's wrong to extract money from the peasantry. It's because on the one hand, the state needs to become more rationally well organized. It needs to become better at collecting taxes from everyone, and then it'll have more tax, and then it can spend that on modernization in other ways. On the other hand, there's a generation in the high aristocracy who got very involved with American independence. I mean, the Marquis de Lafayette is only one of a number of French senior military officers who are involved with Washington's army. There are a number of really quite eminent dukes and peers and so on who are fascinated by American state constitutions, by the language of citizenship and rights that are in those constitutions. But they are simply sort of mentally detached from the idea that that might apply to a peasant. You know, they can vigorously imagine themselves as people who would have citizenship rights, and that that would make life better for the country as a whole, that the monarchy couldn't do all the oppressive things they're worried about it doing. But there is just a kind of blank space between that self-perception and the idea that the peasantry might become citizens. This is one of the things where as you go into the revolution, you see a lot of this kind of blank incomprehension. The idea that there might be political initiative from below, it just doesn't make sense to them. The peasantry are almost literally beasts of burden in their mental universe.
You're talking about these grand, really complex forces. So I'm kind of taken aback, and I don't even know if the next question has any sense at all. But Louis XVI, the mm-hmm. king, we always hear about him being an exceptionally feeble, weak-minded, and unfit ruler.
Mm-hmm.
How much did his rule matter in the course of these events, in the grand scheme of things? Would a different ruler be able to deal with the mounting problems a bit better or differently?
Yeah. At a straightforward practical level, I think it's undeniable that the character of Louis XVI really does matter, because this is a monarchy in which the character of the monarch emphatically matters. Executive government depends on individual ministers who have the confidence of the monarch. When they lose the confidence of the monarch, they get replaced very quickly, because they are part of this terrible, churning, competitive world that I was talking about earlier. You know, when you become powerful, everyone else is out to get you because they want to be powerful instead of you. Factions and families and agitations running all through this. Some of it with a gloss of political principle, some of it naked self-interest and ambition. But only the king can regulate that. Only the king can keep all that competition under control. It's what Louis XIV was exceptionally good at, taking everyone out to Versailles, making them behave themselves, making himself dominant over them. And Louis XV had struggled to live up to that image, and sometimes succeeded and sometimes failed. You know, one of the problems of Louis XV's reign is they never quite achieve successful reform. But if we focus in on the end of Louis XV's reign and the succession of Louis XVI, you can see what the impacts of this are. So for the last 4 years of his reign, 1771-4, Louis XV had acted in a very absolutist way. With his government ministers, he had abolished what are called the parliaments, which are law courts, which challenged his legislative authority. He's abolished them, which is incredibly unpopular. You know, people across the country, the chattering classes, the elite, they hate this because it's despotic, it's tyrannical, it's challenging tradition. But they make it stick for 4 years. And this is part of the grand plan to reform administration generally, rationalise taxation, etc., etc. They make it stick. Louis XV dies, radically unpopular. Louis XVI comes to the throne. He's only 19. He desires to be popular. He desires to be a good king. So what he does is he restores the parliaments to their traditional powers and prerogatives, as a gesture of good kingship. And the problem is that the parliaments are not grateful. they still don't want to give him anything. They don't want to allow him to do any reforms any more than they did his grandfather, Louis XV. So seeking popularity, seeking to be seen as good, completely backfires on Louis XVI from the very beginning of his reign. And then again, he tries to bring in very radical reforms. The minister Turgot, who is driven by Enlightenment principles, proposes a whole series of radical changes to the way the economy and privilege will work. And these are, again, desperately unpopular. And 2 years after he comes into the job, Louis XVI is driven to sack him. So within the first 2 years of coming to power, Louis XVI's desire to be popular has made the opposition to him more powerful. And then his weakness of character in sacking Turgot has left him a hostage to these conservative forces. Now, a stronger minded king might have continued with the rationalizing reforms of Louis XV, or he might have continued with his own rationalizing reforms under Turgot. But Louis XVI wasn't capable of doing either of those things. The only really significant sort of economic management that then happens for the next 10 years is when they bring in Jacques Necker to run the state's finances during the American War. And Necker is seen as a financial genius, as a savior of the country. But all he's actually good at doing is, you know, getting international money markets to lend France money. And he doesn't change the taxation system effectively. He just borrows more effectively. And then he himself is pushed out of office by intrigue and disagreement before the end of the war. And they have to go through a whole series of other government ministers to try to find someone who's willing to tackle the crisis, ending up with Calonne from 1783, who will end up pushing France towards the pre-revolution. And Louis XVI tries to back Calonne, but he ends up sacking him too in early 1787, when things start to go wrong again, when there's objection and resistance from the elite. So long before you've actually gone into actual revolution, there have been a series of occasions where the weakness of the character of Louis XVI has stopped a significant change being able to happen. And the cumulative effect of failing to do all those changes is that the situation just gets worse and worse until it is completely unmanageable anyway. So a different king would definitely have had a different influence on that medium to long term outcome.
You mentioned a couple of times that he was driven to sack this finance minister or the other one, and that he was in effect being held a hostage to other interests. So which were the forces that were actually holding the cards here, if it wasn't the King of France?
Well, it's the general, the existence of a court, the existence of other ministers. I mean, they are all, in order to be powerful, you have to have powerful friends. You have to be part of a faction. You have to be in political maneuver with the other factions all the time. And again, one of the ways in which previous kings balance this out is, ironically, by taking mistresses. If you have a mistress at court, she literally becomes a conduit for influence, a deniable way of maintaining relationships with some groups, a route for pushing patronage towards others. The king's sexual life is part of his political life. And both Louis XV and Louis XIV and earlier kings, they're involved in this. You know, their own libido, their desire for attractive women around them. Again, I mean, this is not abnormal for aristocrats in general. Marriage is very much an economic transaction. No one is expected to love their wife. Being lovers is normal in an aristocratic court society. But the weird thing about Louis XVI is he does appear to love his wife. This is one of his problems, is that he doesn't take a mistress. He is conspicuously uxorious, while at the same time also being rumoured to be sexually incompetent. You know, so at that very sort of fundamentally sort of personal level, he is seen as being a failure as a man, and thus as being generally weak and exploitable. And, you know, thus his own brothers push him around politically, feel they're entitled to argue with him, tell him what to do. Marie Antoinette as queen by the later 1780s is trying to support her husband by being more involved in political discussions and decision-making and listening to different factions and trying to decide what to do. But that in itself is seen by some as kind of debasing him, that she's able to be that important, that influential, when, of course, she's actually a foreigner. She is actually Austrian. And then there are a lot of people in the French court who are fundamentally hostile to Austrian power. They're their historical rivals. So for a whole series of reasons, Louis XVI over and over again is in this position where other people are able to think they can tell him what to do. And one of his problems personality-wise is, I think one of his brothers at one point actually likens him to a cushion, that he bears the impression of the last person who sat on him. You know, if you get to
Louis XVI
last...
What a diss.
You
that
are the
hurts.
One, yeah, you are the one that will have the influence. He'll listen to three people and do what the third
memory
person
foam.
Said. Yes. But that is the problem. He's not able to pull back from those kind of arguments and pursue his own consistent policy. He's battered by these other forces, and, you know, ends up trying to do some things which are really ambitious in terms of reform, but in the sort of political storms that are playing out, it proves to be impossible to carry them through.
So it's spring 1789. We kind of set the stage for the events that are going to follow. What is, if we can even put it in those terms, what is the final straw that breaks the camel's back? Maybe there are several straws.
Yeah. Well, this is what plays out really over the second half of 1788 into 1789 is the collapse of the monarchy's authority. That in the spring of 1788, trying to overcome resistance, the crown again abolishes the parliaments, like Louis XV had done 16, 17 years earlier. But that only sticks for a few months, because there's unrest in the countryside at large, and there's a sort of an investors' strike, you know. The French crown is dependent month on month on continuing to borrow more money. And by August of 1788, people are refusing to lend it any more money because they think it's in a critical collapse, because they've abolished the parliaments and everything is falling apart.
I'm sorry, just a quick interjection. Who's lending France all of this money?
The international financial markets. I mean, this has been the case, you know, for quite a long time now. You know, the wealthy of Europe are investors in the debt of all the various monarchies. Necker, in particular, has connections with the Swiss financial markets, which he's used in decades before. Necker is now back in power in the late summer of 1788 because he provides a solution to bankruptcy, which is to persuade people to lend money again. But the other solution is to restore the parliaments and to announce there's going to be what is called an Estates General. And an Estates General is more like a parliament in the English sense. It's elected representatives from around the country. And it is a relic of medieval times, much like the British Parliament. Hasn't met since 1614. And the non-existence of the Estates General is an essential marker of the absolutism of the French monarchy. So in one significant sense, once you've decided that you need to have an Estates General, absolutism has collapsed. You are trundling backwards into the medieval past when monarchies were consultative, where they needed the agreement of the powerful around the country in order to do anything. And the whole point of absolutism is the idea that you don't need anyone to agree with you because you're the divinely appointed monarch.
Right. Sort of like the Louis XIV, the Sun King style of ruling.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. It's heading backwards into the past. And what then happens in September 1788 is the question arises, well, you know, it was a long time ago, last time we had an Estates General. How should we actually organize this one? And at this point, another huge chasm opens up, because the judges of the Parliament of Paris say we should do it the old-fashioned way, because we should do everything the old-fashioned way. And therefore, the clergy and the nobility and everyone else will have three separate chambers, and it's like one vote each. So the clergy and the nobility will dominate, because that's the old-fashioned way of doing it.
Very fair.
Very fair. Wider public opinion. All those merchants and lawyers and other people who've been becoming prosperous for the last 100 years, who've been interested in enlightenment and so on, they've been following along with this politics. And at this point, they realise that people like the judges of the parliaments are not on their side, that they, members of the wider third estate, are going to have to stick up for themselves if they want to get anything from this process. And so there is then another political storm that breaks over the country at the end of 1788 into early 1789, where the Crown is forced to agree to allow for twice as many third estate delegates to be elected as each of the other two orders, and defers the question of how the Estates General will meet and vote. You know, they've created the situation where theoretically half of a united body would be made up of the third estate, but they've refused to say whether they'll be allowed to vote by head, whether they'll be allowed to make that matter. So France then rolls on into this really, really complicated and penetrating process of electing representatives to the Estates General and deciding and expressing what the problems are they're going to tackle without it being clear how this is actually going to work out. And this is the point at which everything starts to fall apart in terms of the legitimacy of the state, its control over the situation. Yeah. To produce the representatives, the deputies for the Estates General, a process starts at the village level. Every village is permitted to get together and write what's called a cahier de doléances, a register of grievances, a statement of what they think is wrong, what they think the Estates General should do about it. And in those cahiers de doléances, at the village level, at the town level, at the regional level, all the things that we've been talking about, the taxation structure, the tithes, the seigneurial rights, social hierarchy, problems with agriculture, problems with tax, problems with, you know, privilege in a broader sense, all those things are condemned. They are thrashed to death verbally in this flow of millions of words, millions upon millions of words from every community, from every corner of France. And these cahiers de doléances are condensed into sort of composite regional documents that the 1,200 elected people for the Estates General actually bring with them to Versailles. And in them, you have a sense that everything must change. But as the Estates General gathers, nobody knows how to make it change. And this is where everything comes to a sort of crescendo of tension then, which will explode into actual revolution.
I don't know if this is premature, but when we were talking about the French Revolution in school, the teachers just kind of threw all of these fascinating revolutionary characters, such as Robespierre, Danton, and Marat, mm-hmm. into the mix. Mm-hmm. These people suddenly just appear out of nowhere, at least in the textbooks they did. With kings, that's really easy to accept because they come from a lineage and they mm-hmm. represent pretty much the same character over and over again. But with this new breed of sort of an educated urban revolutionary, it's a completely new thing. At least I remember it felt that way at the time. Mm-hmm. It still does. Where do these people come from and what are the ideas that inspired them? Probably the Enlightenment.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things that makes the experience revolutionary is that an elite, which is, you know, been used to dealing with people where they knew who their fathers and grandfathers were and they understood socially why they were important, they are suddenly confronted with the idea that people can become important because of what they say, because of what they believe and what they stand for. I mean, and this isn't a process that happens immediately. Though, you know, if you think about someone like Maximilien Robespierre, he doesn't really come to prominence. He comes to sort of to notice during the first year or so when the Estates General, that will rename itself the National Assembly, during the first year or so when it's working, he comes to notice because he is so uncompromising. In ultimately a belief in general social equality. Yeah, I mean that's what marks Robespierre out, the idea that there shouldn't be any economic barriers to people participating in citizenship. Yeah. So he's very much opposed to what most other people think are sort of simply logical and sensible rules about, you know, a property qualification for voting, and some sense that some kind of broad, as it were, capitalist social hierarchy, a hierarchy based on property, will necessarily continue to exist. Robespierre doesn't have any sort of particular positive vision of a different kind of society. He's just absolutely emphatic that you can't arbitrarily exclude people from politics just because they don't have a certain amount of money. And in the arguments that are raging through these years, that is a very distinctive position, a position of principle, which he's seen as standing up for. The example of people like Danton and Marat, really interesting because they rise in different ways. Danton, like Robespierre, is a qualified barrister, a lawyer, a member of these rising middle classes. Robespierre is really obscure. He comes from Arras in the north. Nobody knows who he is. Danton is a Parisian. He's someone who's much more self-interested, much more pushy about making a name for himself early on in his career. His route is through local politics in Paris, where out of the revolution there's come a very strong sense that, if you like, sovereignty really does exist at the neighborhood level. You know, actual people who live together, getting together and taking decisions for themselves, they're sovereign, and everything above them is a kind of delegation of power that can be withdrawn. It's extremely sort of radical, bottom-up view of what political power is, that nobody except them shares. But because they're in Paris, they can make a lot of noise, a lot of fuss. And Danton's a very loud, stentorian orator, and quite shameless in his willingness to self-publicize, promote these ideas, push opposition to more hierarchical, top-down visions of power. Marat fits into all of this. Marat is a genuine crank. he's a very interesting pre-revolutionary career as both a medical doctor and a pamphleteer. And he actually holds a privileged position as one of the doctors to the household of the king's brother. But he uses that position to be a radical political crank. And his essential message that he starts publishing in journalism from later 1789 is that the revolution, whatever the revolution is, whatever has been gained by the end of 1789, is under deadly threat from the people who claim to be leading it. And therefore, what his readers must do is rise up and cut off some heads. He's continually, absolutely uncompromising in the idea that the revolution is being actively betrayed. And this gets him into trouble with the actual authorities from very early in his career. But of course, the irony is that the revolution is being actively betrayed by quite a lot of people. So he turns out to be prophetic in that sense, that the revolution is a whole series of betrayals by the powerful from 1789 onwards. And so by 1792-93, for a lot of people, he is the prophet of how radical, how uncompromising they need to be. But they rise up through these new political processes, which are unprecedented, which rely on what people say, on how their ideas are received, rather than who they are or who their family are or what kind of institution they belong to.
Professor, when I did my tiny little research for this interview, I stumbled on quite a sassy revolutionary caricature depicting the Third Estate as a broken old man carrying the First and the Second Estates on his back. I was quite shocked that this kind of, you know, spicy and direct criticism of the regime was allowed in what was still an absolutist monarchy. How is this relative freedom of press possible?
Right. Well, that's an interesting issue. Looking back over the several decades before 1789, in terms of those visual caricatures which are using the language of the Three Estates, most of them date from a period where censorship has broken down. I mean, the idea of state censorship is really collapses around 1788 because public commentary on the Estates General is invited by the Crown and produces all these kind of things. On the one hand, even going ahead into the revolution, visual caricatures that are too rude, too insulting, are still seen as threats to public order, that the revolutionary authorities in 1791, 1792 will still be arresting people and confiscating things for going too far. On the other hand, if you go back in time, there is a tradition which goes back to the middle years of the century, where, again, technically, everything which is not approved is illegal in the publishing realm. You either have official publication, official approval to publish something, or you can't publish it. That's the technical general thing. There is blanket censorship. On the other hand, government ministers are quite sympathetic to a lot of the ideas of the Enlightenment. They know these shouldn't circulate amongst the general population because they would alarm the plebs, but they really don't mind if these things circulate amongst the upper classes quite freely, because, you know, the upper classes are not seen as socially dangerous. You know, ideas, words, images are understood as having an effect proportional to how many in the population encounter them. So if you can keep these things tacitly, you know, in a nudge and a wink kind of way, if you keep them in the social elite, they're not a problem. I mean, the problem is, of course, they don't stay in the social elite. They do leak out. But French government censorship is still quite effective into the middle 1780s in suppressing a lot of the really filthy stuff that circulates. There is a vividly pornographic imagination in the 18th century Enlightenment, and often a kind of politically, sexually libelous imagination as well. A lot of terrible stories are circulated about Marie Antoinette and about other members of the court, often driven, in some cases paid for, by their political rivals. But this again is, you know, the high and the low get connected together, because in this atmosphere of factional conflict, pretty much anything goes. If you can get people to believe that your rivals are sexually depraved, you've gained an advantage over them. You've humiliated them in some way. So all this kind of stuff goes on. And again, what one of the interesting ironies of history is that for a long time, it was thought that a lot of these really vile caricatures of Marie Antoinette did circulate before the revolution. And more recent historical research has kind of figured out that, in fact, a lot of them were basically kept out of circulation, in some cases by literally buying up the stock of physical material. And then a lot of that stuff was actually stored in the Bastille. So that when the Bastille is stormed in July 1789, one of the things that comes out of it is a huge stock of anti-monarchical pornography, which was actually kept out of circulation before the revolution, now goes back into circulation. But a lot of people had assumed that, you know, by the publication date, people had already seen it. But it's actually a phenomenon of revolutionary politics to put this stuff back into circulation. And then it has its various destabilizing effects.
Here's what I always wondered. Let's say you're an average person who can read and write, so probably an urbanite during the revolution. Since birth, you've still been cultivated into this pretty rigid belief system that you talked about, which is roughly that there's a universe ruled by an almighty God, that the church represents said God on earth, that kings have a divine right to rule, and that you have to respect the upper classes, the feudal lord who has direct dominion over you. Not only that, every other country that you know in Europe, all the neighbors are organized according to similar, if not the same, principles. Mm-hmm. And it's been like that for centuries, which probably makes this organization of society seem even more sort of eternal. However, all of a sudden you begin not only hearing, but adopting ideas about, like you said, Robespierre, equality, about the king being just a man, about a universe without a god in it even. How is this unbelievably radical shift of ideas possible? And how are people receptive to this? It just seems mind-boggling to me.
Mm. Yeah, but I think, I mean, the very large questions about Western civilization, some of these. one of the ways of approaching it from the baseline is that, socially speaking, in order to have a hierarchy, other people than the people at the very top also have to be quite powerful. They also have to have their rights and privileges. You know, there are necessarily intermediary ranks in a hierarchy. So one of the things that a sort of a complex hierarchical society is also teaching people, you know, beside the fact that the king is allegedly number one, is that you can be number two, three, four, five, six, and so on. That there are ways to rise. There are other kinds of power you can obtain. You're not flattened at the bottom. And that's a message that comes through at a whole series of levels. I mean, it's clear in the countryside that if you can accumulate resources, if you can, for get your son educated by the village priest and then get a scholarship to a local college, then that son could end up at university. They could end up a lawyer. They could make lots of money. They could literally come back, maybe them or their son or their grandson. They could come back and become the lord of the village with enough cash and a willing buyer, a willing seller. They could buy the feudal rights to the village. Nobody can stop them. Possibilities of rise and possibilities of fall are part of the system. Within the urban landscape, there are the trade guilds, which are, again, fundamentally hierarchical structures, you know, based on the idea that you come in, you do an apprenticeship, and you become a journeyman, and you work for a master. Eventually, you become a master, and then you might become a senior officer in the guild. And by the time you've done that, you're probably a rich man. But you started out as a 14-year-old apprentice, getting smacked around the back of the head when you did something wrong. Yeah. So the idea of hierarchy they're working with is not a fixed one. You know, and this is clear, for example, in the concept of nobility. It carries with it fundamental contradictions that they just live with. On the one hand, nobility is supposed to be in the blood. It's supposed to be a hereditary distinction. Some right. advocates would say, you know, the Franks who invaded in the 5th century are a different race to the Gauls, and the nobility descend from the Franks who are superior to the Gauls from whom everyone else. Now, some people would make it racial, but at the same time, the king can ennoble anyone. The king makes people noble. That's a stamp on a piece of paper, and you are noble. What's more, throughout the 18th century, you can buy positions of authority for cash money, which will eventually make you noble. This is part of the way the royal finances work. They sell privilege. So fundamentally contradictory idea, nobility is fixed, but it's also open. And in fact, in practice, it's more open than fixed. Moving up into the nobility is normal for the wealthy. So the whole society is simply inhabiting these contradictions, where some of the messages that come down to them are that, you know, power is fixed and eternal and hierarchical and can't be challenged. Other messages are that you can move through this system. You can move up this system. You personally can become more powerful. Your community could get more privileges. Everything is in play. Nothing is actually fixed. You know, and this is before you, you can go into much wider philosophical discussion about how the separation between secular and religious power in the Christian tradition also re-emphasizes this. Religion doesn't just exist to sanctify power. It's also capable of challenging power. And you know, emperors and popes contested for authority all through the Middle Ages. It's understood that this is a space of contestation. You know, so people going into 1789 would understand perfectly well that one of the things you can try to do is get back some power from the monarchy. You can try and get them to treat you more fairly, more openly. There's nothing unbelievable in doing that. Yeah. What is unbelievable is the idea that you could overturn the whole social structure, that you could threaten property, which is where the revolution will run into sort of really serious problems when it looks like, you know, property might need to be in question.
the three estates have gathered to try to solve many issues that are that the French state is facing, mm-hmm. not least the economic crisis that is looming. How do we go from that to people storming the Bastille and imprisoning the royal family?
Well, I mean, the royal family doesn't get imprisoned for several years, so you worry about that. But in terms of what happens in 1789, when the Estates General meet, I mean, the first thing that happens is that the royal government fails to give a strong lead. The royal government could have told them either to meet as three separate orders or to meet as one, but it failed to tell them to do either thing. It left them to think about it. It also failed to give them a strong lead on what kind of reforms it wanted to see come out of the meeting. So again, throughout most of May and early June 1789, these 1,200 people, 630 state people, 300 nobles, 300 clergy, are left to their own devices to figure out who they are. And what emerges is that the third estate, the nobility in particular, have very strongly opposed visions of what should happen. The nobility, the majority of the nobility, are absolutely certain that they should meet separately. They shouldn't be folded into the third estate and forced to share power with them. The third estate, you know, 600 strangers, most of whom have never met each other before, they spend these weeks in discussion, in debate, meeting in their chamber every day because they've got nothing else to do. Forming a political identity, which is around the idea that they do, in fact, have to take a lead. They have to be the nation. They have to push forward. And so on 17th of June, most of the Third Estate, joined by a few members of the clergy and a handful of the nobility, they declare that they are the National Assembly and that they are going to write a constitution. And that in the meantime, on their authority, the authority of the National Assembly, people should carry on paying their taxes because they, the National Assembly, are guaranteeing the state's debts.
All right. So they're sort of having a, there's a new sheriff in town for the moment.
That is, in one sense, an absolute seizure of sovereign authority. They just stand up and say, we are now the National Assembly. You know, when you pay tax, you're paying it to us, and we are guaranteeing that the debts of the state will be repaid. You know, that's what people are really worried about in 1789, actual state bankruptcy, which would ruin a lot of people.
Just a quick question here.
By seizing control of the debt.
Yeah, just a quick question. Were any of the representatives of the third estate, were any of them peasants, or are we talking mostly about bourgeoisie?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think there is famously one person who is an actual kind of... agricultural.
I see. Okay. Enough said.
Okay. No, I mean, over half of them are lawyers of one kind or another, right. And most of the rest then in property owners, merchants.
Get the picture.
It's essentially a gathering of leisured people because they've had to give up months of their time.
I see. Oh, that's why you said they have nothing else to do.
Yeah, I mean, they have come there to do this thing from the four corners of the country, and then between the 17th of June. And a few days later, there is, cacophony at court. There's what looks like a threat to disband them, which leads them to swear what's called the tennis court oath. They go to this indoor tennis court in Versailles and they swear an oath, not only that they will give France a constitution, but that if they are separated, if they are dispersed to the four corners of the country, they will find their way back together. In defiance of royal power to give France a constitution. So in June, before any overt violence, there's already been this conceptual revolution. These guys are declaring essentially absolutism to be dead and buried before they've actually made any changes. That's the one change they've introduced. And this will rumble forward then for the next 3 or 4 weeks until the more conservative forces around the king pressure him to try and stop this, because it is the destruction of his authority. It has to be stopped.
How come the army was not called in immediately to just disperse them?
That's the direction they head in. I mean, it takes time to assemble troops. One of the problems that the nation's been having has been very, very widespread rural unrest. You know, the peasantry are revolting in the first half of 1789, and the army has been spread out around the country trying to contain these things. But quite large numbers of troops do assemble towards Paris in early July, precisely to provide a military solution, to segregate the assembly in Versailles from the population of Paris, which is being very loud in its support. But most of the troops are not happy with this. You know, and this is, again, the sense that royal authority is already in collapse, that the generals themselves tell the king and the council of ministers that they cannot guarantee that troops will obey orders to attack Paris. So when they attempt a coup d'etat on the 11th of July, they attempt to get rid of the minister Necker. They attempt to secure Paris. They systematically fail. The population of Paris rises up, seizes physical control of the city's space, of its walls and its gates, rescues a huge number of weapons from the Invalides. And the reason they actually go to the Bastille on the 14th is to get the gunpowder to load the weapons that they've got. And the confrontation there has its own history and its own complexity. But in the end, the fall of the Bastille becomes symbolic, partly because the Bastille is a prison. It's understood as the place where people were sent for decades if they offended royal authority. But it's essentially a warehouse, and a fortified warehouse in July 1789. But it's because the governor refuses to surrender, because a whole load of people get killed, it then becomes emblematic of a revolution that does need to be violent to be carried through. That Paris was under threat of being destroyed and had saved itself and had saved the country. And on the 15th, the king literally physically admits this, because he physically goes to the National Assembly in its meeting place and more or less surrenders to them. And on the 17th of July, he physically goes to central Paris and more or less surrenders to the insurrection there. And everyone's very happy about this because they want the king to be on their side. But from the point of view of his own brothers and a lot of other conservative people, he's just shown again the fundamental weakness of his character. He's given in to this rebellion, and they'll never forgive him for that. And so counter-revolution and revolution create each other. And this struggle will then play out over the whole rest of the decade and be the framing for how the revolution's seen in terms of longer term history.
Do the revolutionary parties exist here already? Did they begin to form or not yet? And if they have, what are some of the major differences between them?
There isn't really a party system as you understand it forming in the 19th century. What there is, and again, it's an interesting part of the process. There are groups who come together because they think they represent the most advanced patriotic views. And you will end up through 1790 and 1791 with a nationwide network of what we can come to call Jacobin clubs.
Yep.
Because the first one starts in Paris in a Jacobin monastery, because this is a public space that's available for meetings. So you will end up with thousands of Jacobin clubs around the country, who do have a very particular ideology, but their ideology is that we are the good patriots. That's what it boils down to. We are the good citizens. Everyone else is potentially a counter-revolutionary. You know, so they have very particular views on how things should be done and what they want to see happen. But it essentially starts from a perspective of our opinions are not politics. Our opinions are just the right opinions, which is, of course, what most political parties think. But it's particularly self-evident, yes, in this case that it's very much conceptualized as a for and against the revolution, the nation, the rights of man. You know, if you're for all of those things, then you're on the side of the Jacobins. If you're not, you're a counter-revolutionary. And what's going to happen through the years of the revolution is more and more people get squeezed out of Jacobinism and object, told that they are counter-revolutionary, because the idea of what it means to be Jacobin, to be a good citizen, becomes narrower and narrower under greater and greater pressure of circumstances. That there is a drive towards purity and purification, which is also a drive towards purging and exclusion. And, you know, from 1790 to 1794, that is much of the history of the revolution, is of people who were part of the revolutionary tent being pushed out of it, and in many cases ultimately executed, persecuted because of that.
So the king is publicly surrendering some of his power to the revolutionaries. How loud is the alarm sounding in other neighboring monarchies while this is happening, such as Britain, Spain, Austria, and Prussia, who are observing all of this from the outside?
Yeah, I mean, it's seen differently in different places. I mean, early on, kind of 1789-90, most of the other powers of Europe are just kind of sort of smirking, laughing behind their hands at what's happening in France, because, you know, it's a humiliation for France. At the diplomatic level, the British are extremely smug about what's happening. You know, they have a sort of general conception this might be France catching up with where Britain was in the 1680s with its glorious revolution. If France becomes a parliamentary monarchy, then it'll still be 100 years behind us, but it's a better thing for the world. A lot of the other powers of Europe are thinking about this in terms of ongoing real tensions in Central Europe. For example, I mean, there is rebellion in the Dutch Republic in 1787. There's a rebellion in the Austrian Netherlands, Belgium in 1790. France's diplomatic weakness there is to the advantage of all the other powers who get what they want and what France doesn't. Shortly after this, there's going to be another partition of Poland. And one of the reasons that can happen and be sort of very aggressively pursued by Prussia and Austria and Russia is that France can't do anything about it. France is off the diplomatic table. So early in the revolution, there is a sense that everybody else is just feeling very smug about France in collapse. But from 1791-92, particularly the Habsburgs, then followed gradually by the Prussians and Russians, are going to start to think, well, actually, this is going too far. That we need to start putting pressure on France to give our brother monarch some of his power back. And of course, then when France actually topples the monarchy and executes the king, they're making themselves into outlaws on the European stage. You know, and that's, you know, that really is fundamentally the sense there that what's happened in France is a species of madness that needs to be exterminated. And French counter-revolutionaries, of course, will pursue this vigorously, as will propagandists. I mean, most famously, Edmund Burke, in the British context, puts forward this view at the end of 1790 that the swinish multitude have destroyed a flourishing hierarchical society, and it's the duty of every good person to put things back to the way they were. That very much sense that ordinary people exist to be despised by more important people is part of that understanding. You know, so again, this is not to say that those other powers don't continue to try and take advantage of the situation. And if you look at the outbreak of war in 1792 from an international diplomatic perspective, you get very different answers as to why it happened from if you look at it from the point of view of French revolutionary radicals. Yeah, they think the war started to defend the revolution. Diplomats think the war has started for about 16 other different reasons as well. You know, the self-interest of all these powers are still wrapped up in what eventually happens.
We're going to have to leave it off with a bit of a cliffhanger there. I do hope you can come back. I just have one quick last question for you. Let's settle this once and for all. Did Marie Antoinette's famous "let them eat cake" moment really happen?
No, that's a quote that's in something that Rousseau wrote. And when he wrote it, he was quoting an urban legend about a Russian princess. You know, so the words exist in French literature long before the revolutionary crisis. They just get pasted onto Marie Antoinette afterwards because they seem so apt.
So we have come full circle because we're ending where we began with Eastern Europe. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Professor. Do you have any social media where people can follow your work?
Yeah, my Twitter account is Prof. Dave Andress. I'm quite active on there. I do have a Blue Sky account, but I very rarely use it. So Twitter's where I can generally be
found. All right. Thank you so much. This was absolutely fantastic. Thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to Smart Cookies on YouTube. What else is there? Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you really liked what you heard, feel free to become my patron on Patreon by going to Patreon and becoming my patron. It's really easy. Just type Smart Cookies Podcast in there. You should be able to find me. Last but not least, I have to thank the absolute legends that are my producers on this show, my existing patrons on Patreon: Aida, Mancian, Micha Medved, Medinho, Gordon, Jurechuk, Lorenzo, Mila, Carmen, Taichi, Goran, and Veronica. Without you guys, this show wouldn't exist. So massive thanks. And yeah, see you in the next episode. Bye.